Greetings, my friends. This is Mark Foster, your host of Newport Legacy Insights, our monthly podcast. I'm happy to be here for our third call. Today, I am back in the beautiful state of Montana after being in Newport Beach for November. It was wonderful, frankly, to be in Newport and be with our kids and our grandkids and all of our friends. And now we're looking forward to the kids coming up for the holidays, which is going to be epic. It is currently, I know in California, it's nice and warm and beautiful, but here it is a combination of snowing and raining. And hopefully that rain isn't going to screw up the snow because I'm planning on starting my ski season here in the next couple days. In our discussion that we're going to have today, I am so happy to be joined by the great John Woloshin, the co-head of wealth management research at UBS. Many of you know John and enjoy listening to John, and hence you know John is a guy that definitely has some opinions. So John, thank you so much for being here today. I really appreciate
it. Oh, my pleasure, and thanks for having me back again, Mark.
Well, no, it's really my pleasure. I enjoy your friendship and I enjoy all of our chats and discussions. So, you know, today's episode might be a little longer than normal since there's a fair amount to cover. We're going to discuss three different topics, or, you know, like three different segments in essence. To begin with, John is going to inform us as to what UBS expects from the markets in 2026, you know, regarding equities, bonds, commercial real estate, and whatever he thinks we should be thinking about. Our second little segment or discussion is going to be around the growing concerns about the affordability issue, which seems to be becoming a more of a political football. John and I chatted about this about a month or 6 weeks ago and thought it might be an interesting topic of discussion. And then we'll roll into the third segment, which is basically how should we invest and plan giving, you know, this affordability issue or concern? I mean, potentially, you know, could this cause some sort of political changes? For example, in the state of California, there's a high likelihood that we're going to have a wealth tax proposal on the ballot in November. So in essence, it could change some of our, you know, long-term perspectives in terms of how we invest money or how we position things or some of the estate considerations. So John, let's get rolling. Tell us, you know, what do you expect, or what does UBS expect for the market in 2026?
When we published our year ahead outlook about a week or so ago, I guess, the view was that we saw for the end of December of 26, we thought the S&P could hit a level of 7,700, which based on when I looked at the numbers earlier today, that would point to a little less than 12% upside. Our view on interest rates, which is very topical as of today, we thought that the Fed would cut today, which they did. And we're looking for, you know, a 10-year treasury around 375. Those are really sort of the two key markers. I don't think, and obviously we're still digesting today's news, I don't think anything that came out today in terms of either what the Fed did or more importantly what they said is probably going to alter that view. Not that I want to put too much into one company. Oracle did release after the close, and I think a lot of eyes are on that for what it might mean for AI, and AI is certainly a very, very big driver of the market outlook. But, you know, as we look across the fundamental backdrop, the key here is there's so much focus on our rates going to go down. And one of the things that I look at, and maybe I'm hypersensitive to this, you know, covering real estate, to me, it's more stability in rates. And, you know, it appears that we've gotten to a period of more stability in rates, which is good. The earnings outlook is reasonably good. I think it's probably slowed down from where it was because there are, you know, there are some cross currents in the economy. We have seen a number of high profile layoff announcements, but at the same time, you're seeing the IPO market open up somewhat more. You know, you've got SpaceX going out there talking about an IPO at a very, very large valuation. You still got a ton of spending in AI. So we think the backdrop with the obvious, you know, unknowns and caveats of geopolitics of the upcoming midterms in 26, we think the backdrop is still reasonably good and conducive for positive returns. Very high level commentary.
Yeah. Well, the idea of a 3.75 10-year treasury, I think, is great if we get there. You know, my concern had been that, you know, we keep lowering short-term rates and the yield curve steepens because of inflation. But given a shout out to Jerome Powell, I thought his news conference today was great. One thing that he mentioned is that service inflation is perhaps sub 2% and goods inflation is closer to 3%. And that's predominantly caused by tariffs. Tariffs are hypothetically a, you know, one-time event. So without the tariff effect, we would be closer to that 2% target. And, you know, frankly, you know, that 2% target to me seemed kind of crazy because historically we've had 3% inflation. But he commented, you mentioned layoffs, he commented on job formation actually being potentially negative. So, you know, I wonder if that's a function of AI or a function of the border being closed or a function of what. But in essence, from his commentary this afternoon, it sounded like we could see a 3.75 treasury, 10-year treasury, and we could actually see rates continuing to come down. So I'm kind of surprised. Wasn't sold on UBS's idea that the 10-year was going to be coming down until I listened to Powell this afternoon. So
yeah, and Mark, and just one thing I would talk about, the services side of inflation, and I think we've talked about this in the past. I would argue that we're actually below the 2%. And the reason I say this is because the single biggest component, not only of services, but of all of CPI, is shelter, which is this nebulous owner's equivalent rent calculation. And the methodology, as I've told anybody who will listen to me, is to be charitable, incredibly suboptimal. And if you were to take this owner's equivalent rent, which is a non-observable figure, and actually go out and just look at apartment rents or single family home rents, I would argue that we're already there. Now, that all that said, yes, the tariffs are inflationary, even though it's a one-time move. If you think about this K-shaped economy we're in, the people who can least afford the brunt of this are taking it. So they're not sitting there and saying, oh, it's a one-time hit. They're saying, this is affecting my spending patterns.
Hey, let me ask you this. Everybody's starting to throw around the term, the K-shaped economy. So a lot of people on the call don't know what you're talking about. So could you explain what a K-shaped economy actually is?
Absolutely. So just think of the letter K. So you have, forget the vertical line, but you have with a K, you have one line that's going up and to the right and one line that's going down and to the right. And so what I'll call a normalized economy, to the extent we know what normalized is, the rising tide is lifting all boats, if you will. But in a K-shaped economy, you've really got, you know, significant dispersion in who's benefiting. So if you look at risk assets, let's just pick the stock market as sort of the key risk asset. Stock market is having another good year on the back of, you know, several good years. And so the upper end of the economy that owns real assets and risk assets is benefiting, whereas you have the middle to lower end of the economy, which has certainly been, you know, on the short end of the stick in terms of layoffs, in terms of wage increases. And I'm not talking about, I know a lot of people tout the hourly wage increases, but if you look at the cost of living relative to those wages, they're definitely on the downside. And so that's what I mean by the K-shape. It's the old phrase, the rich are getting richer and everybody else is not benefiting anywhere near the way the upper end of the economy is.
Well, that's kind of a perfect segue into our second little segment. So changing gears, you know, frankly, I'm really sick of politics these days. It's become tiresome.
Yes, we all are.
Yeah. And hopefully the political extremes that we have will push the majority of people back to the middle and there'll be a little bit of sanity. And I got to hand it to the Democrats. This recent discussion about affordability by the Democrats is really a great strategy. It's a great strategy for them to reconnect with the common person. You know, everybody feels like stuff just costs more. And the idea of affordability issues resonates with a lot of people. Right now, regarding affordability, the principal talking points are mostly centered on housing, which is your bailiwick, also cost of higher education, in essence, student loan debt, and healthcare. But, you know, given your real estate expertise and my assumption that the American dream kind of starts with a white picket fence, What do you do about this? What do you do to address this growing concern about affordability?
Well, if we're talking about it, I mean, and look, affordability is a very, very large topic. And so if we're talking, you know, about, you know, everyday items, and we're talking about inflation before, well, I mean, without making this political, take your foot off the tariffs. I mean, and I don't want to get into the, you know, the politics of it, but the tariffs are certainly the issue. If we're talking about shelter, and I mean shelter in terms of both for ownership and rental housing, you know, it's sort of like the old thing in oil, the cure for high prices is high prices. Well, oil is a globally traded commodity, and although it's a regulated industry, it tends to be, it's globally fungible largely, whereas real estate is hyper-local. And so real estate is governed by a lot of things, including kind of local rules, if you will. California has been one market. New York, where I live, is another, where they have artificial rent controls. They have exclusionary zoning. They have all these things that are preventing more development. And so if you want to lower prices, you build more. It's very, very straightforward. And so this is very much of a political issue, and we saw it here. And I think this is one of the things, as you pointed out, Mayor-elect Mamdani, I think that's one of the things that put him over the top. I think he ran a brilliant campaign, but he did focus not only on affordability, but specifically affordability of housing, where in New York, it is very, very challenging. Unfortunately, he has fallen into what I'm going to call the trap of playing the populist argument of, we're going to freeze the rent. Well, okay, that's a short-term fix that causes nothing but long-term problems. And just ask the city of Los Angeles, which just put in even more stringent regulations, and you're going to have developers who are going to take their money and go elsewhere. It's pretty straightforward. So I think if you want to lower prices, you have more supply. Now, look, there are some markets like coastal California. There's only so much coast, and I get it. But that's really the issue. There's no magic to this.
Let me touch on that supply thing. Man, talk about hitting the nail on the head. I think a lot of times inflation is a result of inappropriate government response to problems. You know, for example, you know, some of the inflationary problems we've had as of late, you know, the housing issue, which I think started in the great financial recession back in 2008-09, when government regulation, that FASB 105, kind of destroyed the bank systems, and all of a sudden housing construction stopped. So we went from 1.7 million houses a year to 1 million a year, probably closer to 1 million a year. So over 15 years, you know, that's gives you a shortage of about somewhere between 5 and 10 million houses on a base of 90 million houses in the country. So we're probably short 10% all the way across the board. Then adding more examples, you get into the COVID situation. So there's an overreaction to the pandemic. They print a bunch of money. They destroy the supply chain. And what do we get? We get a bunch of inflation. And now you mentioned the tariffs. Tariffs disrupting the supply chain, creating more inflation. So whether it's the housing issues post-2009, or if it's post-COVID issues destroying the supply chain, or if it's the tariffs, I mean, basically, you disrupt the supply chain and you pump money into the system, bingo, you got inflation. And that's kind of how we got to where we are. How do you get out of it if you don't build 5 or 10 million houses? How do you get them to? Is there a government response that could take place that could induce us to build 5+ million houses?
Funny you should ask that. And the reason I'm laughing because I had this conversation with my very left-leaning mother yesterday. And suffice it to say, we are diametrically opposed politically. But we actually had a very, very sober and rational conversation about this. And that was the very question she asked me. But I do want to say one thing before I answer this, that I would take issue with the 10 million housing units short. I think that number is on the high side. I don't dispute we're short, but I think that's a little high. But so when she asked me, what can be done? Can this be solved? They said it can be solved very easily, which is some sort of public-private type partnership. But I very quickly followed that up with, but the problem is that the politics get in the way. And as long as there is this belief amongst one side of the aisle that capitalism is evil and profits are evil, we're going to have a problem here. And you mentioned the global financial crisis. And to me, the single most successful program that helped get us out of the GFC was what was called the PPIP, the Public-Private Investment Partnership Program. And effectively, and I'm shortcutting this a little bit, what the government did was they went to all this private, you know, the private equity and the banks and everybody said, we'll lend you money at effectively a 0% interest rate. And by the way, we will take a first loss position on any loans. And that kickstarted things. And, you know, I think of life in terms of virtuous and vicious cycles. You need something if you're in a vicious cycle to get you out of that virtuous cycle. But once that happens, you can shift very, very quickly from one to the other. And that helped us shift to a virtuous cycle. I'm not looking for a massive government bailout here, but what I'm looking for is for everybody to say, okay, there is no reward without risk. And risk takers need to earn, and we can debate what the word reasonable means, a reasonable risk-adjusted return on their capital. And I have no problem saying, and if, I'm sure there's going to be developers listening to this who may disagree with me, but saying, okay, so we, the government, whether it's state government, the local government, the federal government, what have you, steps in and says, we're going to ease zoning restrictions. We're going to make land available. And I'm just kind of spitballing things here. But your requirement, Mr. or Ms. Developer, is, I'm again making numbers up here, 10 to 15 to 20% of units have to be, whether it's workforce or affordable, however we define it. And I guarantee you, if you do that and you take the politics out of it and say, and I'll look at what California did with their rent control in 2019. They said that the lesser of, I think it was 10%, and either that or, you know, base rate plus local CPI. That's reasonable. You can earn return. You can offset your costs that go on. But what I see going on, whether it's in Boston, the city of Los Angeles, New York, Minneapolis, Prince George's County in Maryland, just to name a few, they're putting in these incredibly preposterous risk controls. In fact, the best example I can give you is the city of St. Paul. And this is probably going back to, I think it's Minnesota. I think it was 2021, if I remember. And the city council put in a maximum 3% rent increase across the board. Within one quarter, they lost 2/3 of the building permits for new apartment units. That's the greatest real-time market result I've seen. And so it's a long-winded answer, Mark, but it's important. Yes, this is solvable. But as long as we're going to have this divide between capitalism and insert whatever word you want on the other side, we have to stop demonizing capitalism. We have to stop demonizing reasonable profit. Now, if you have people that are bad actors, fine. I have no problem saying, hey, you're a bad actor. That doesn't work. But as long as we have this problem, you're going to have artificial policy or bad policy or suboptimal policy, which will lead to artificial shortages. And we know what happens then.
Yeah, clearly. Affordability issues. On that affordability stool, the next leg of that stool is clearly medical costs, basically probably our biggest national challenge. And it's the biggest contributor to our national debt. Actually, next month, I'm going to have Eric Podiker, however you pronounce it, on the podcast to talk about that. So we don't need to discuss that today, but I guess the third leg of that stool is, or it's claimed to be, student loans. You know, we've gone from $400 billion to almost $2 trillion in student loan debt. I mean, the cost of education is probably driven by the fact that these students have unlimited access to these loans. And at some point, you know, the cost-benefit factor needs to be calced in there. But do you consider that part of the American dream, in essence, you know, entitlement to get a college degree and come out and get a nice big high-paying job as soon as you're done? Any thoughts on that one?
Well, I have a lot of thoughts on that, as you might expect.
Yep.
So I think back to when I started college in 1977, and I went to a private university. So, and I look at what my tuition was. My kids, who are now almost 31 and 28, I look at what it cost to send them to two private institutions, and just the differential between when they went and now, and the numbers are absolutely astounding. And while I feel for people with student debt, I would make a few observations. Number one, I think the wrong questions are being asked by the people who are overseeing this. It's not should we be forgiving student debt? It's why is college so expensive? Right. And it's expensive for a lot of reasons. So when you have, you know, when you're Harvard or Stanford or MIT or insert high quality university there, and you're accepting 5 to 7% of your students, number one, and number two, you have a lot of foreign students who are paying full freight, you can sort of understand the supply demand is definitely in their favor. But, you know, universities are not run like businesses. And I say this as somebody who's not in the university or education business. The other problem is when the student loan business was, for all intents and purposes, federalized, I believe it was under the Obama administration, what they did was they just gave colleges a blank check. Because I'm a big believer in a college education, but I would say two things. Number one, and I just had my plumber here a couple of days ago, geez, there's nothing wrong with the trade school. And I think there are a lot of very, very important, viable, and honorable trades. Not everyone should go to college, number one.
Let me comment on that. Yeah, please. You were just teeing me up on this one. I mean,
I don't mean to play straight, man, but hey, go for it.
Well, first off, the AI thing is going to have probably hit the white collar workers first. There's no question. And we definitely need tradespeople for sure. And because of that, I thought I had like the world's greatest idea. You know, Congress created something called a 529 plan where you can put money away for your kids' college education. So, you know, my thought was this, is that if parents are going to put money into a 529 plan, and you never know what's going to happen in life, right? You know, will the kid really go to school? You know, what's going to happen? But if you set, if they change the rules governing the 529 plans, where whatever is in there, when your child, if they decide to go into the military or if they decide to go to trade school and, you know, they have a big fat balance in their 529 plan, why can't they use that money to start a new business? A new business that ultimately is going to create tax income for the government. It'd be great if, you know, you go and become a plumber, an electrician, whatever. And then as soon as you're, you know, skilled, you can start your own business with the amount of money that you have in your 529 plan and you're off and running.
I remember, and I don't need to keep making everything about my family, but it was near and dear to my heart. When my kids were applying to college, this is what I said to them. I said, you could major in anything you want. I said, I'm only going to pay, your mother and I are only going to pay for a major that gives you a shot at a job. I don't care what that major is, but if it's something, if you want to study something that is touchy-feely and near and dear to your heart, I'm not going to get in your way, but you better get used to student loans. I've had this debate with, I'm going to go back to my mother because we are on opposite sides of the aisle, and she talks to me about, well, it's, you know, humanities are important and this is important. By the way, I 100% agree with that. My father was in the music business, for God's sake, so I totally understand this. And so what I said to her was, you can, of course, you can get exposure to that. You can have a minor in that. But if you're going to go to college and spend $80,000, $90,000, $100,000 a year to major in something that is not going to give you a shot either at a job or something that is maybe a very, very worthwhile profession, but is going to keep you in debt the rest of your life, I think you need to think about that, is all I'm saying.
Yeah. No, and I don't know how you solve that issue, because the schools are going to push back from any kind of restructuring, that's for sure. So
no argument.
Yeah. So given, you know, that rolls us right into the third section here. Given this focus and concern about these affordability issues, the challenge to the American dream, in essence, you know, and all this political backlash, is the American investment miracle threatened, in essence? A lot of us have significant investment gains, and the idea, especially, you know, someone in my demographic, you know, gray hair and all, thinking that you're going to sit on these giant gains and you're going to get a step up in basis and you're going to leave that to the next generation. Is that whole model threatened? I mean, could we see a whole bunch of wealth-oriented taxes? Could we see things basically change, suggesting it just hasn't been fair? The people that have been the investors are going to be the ones that are going to pay for it.
At the federal level, not until the Democrats control both houses of Congress and the White House, And this is now, I want to be clear on this for your listeners. This is a personal view. This is not a UBS view. That if that day comes, but they don't have 60 seats in the Senate, I believe that the suspension of the filibuster is a very high risk. So I think that's where those risks nationally grow. At the state level, the answer is yes. I mean, I know California has proposed several times some sort of wealth tax. Now I know because Newsom, I assume, is going to run for president in 28. So he, you know, he's trying to thread the needle in the middle. But, you know, and I'm not an expert in the ballot initiative process in California, but what if they made it a ballot initiative? It would probably have a reasonable likelihood of passing.
It is. I think it's going to be on the ballot in November.
It is going to be a ballot initiative. Okay.
Yeah, they got all they need is 870,000 votes to get it on the ballot in November. And it, basically, the issue is there's 200 billionaires in the state of California, and each billionaire would have to give 5% of their total net worth. And if they can get 870,000 votes out of what, 38 million people? So out of 38 million people, where only 200 of them are billionaires, do you think anyone would basically propose that as a potential way of closing our budget deficit?
On a ballot initiative, no, but here's the thing. And we saw the two states that come to mind for me are Oregon and Maryland. I think Oregon might have been 2016, Maryland, I don't remember when. They both put in these quote-unquote millionaire surcharges. Oregon lost 80 millionaires, you know, in 5 seconds. And, you know, we live in a dynamic, not a static world. And this is of the many problems in politics. One of them is most politicians on both sides of the aisle think statically, not dynamically. To me, I would like to look at a Tom Steyer and see how he behaves. Because, you know, Tom Steyer has been very upfront about his politics. But I suspect that if this comes to pass, a lot of folks are going to say, I'm going elsewhere. You know, I've seen this. And, you know, Mark, when you and I talked and we did our pre-call, I mentioned that I had done a presentation up in Seattle a while back. And we were and one of the questions that came up was not only the capital gains tax, but inheritance taxes. And I relayed a line that somebody said to me. He said, State of Washington is a great place to work, but you don't want to die there. And so what you're seeing is a lot of people, as they transition from their working accumulation years to their I got to protect it years, are saying, I'm just going over the border to Idaho. So I do believe that you're going to see more and more. And while I don't want to make too much of Mikey Sherrill winning the governorship in New Jersey, I don't think that was a huge surprise. Mamdani, I think it, to a degree, not that he won was a surprise. The fact that he even got to the point that he could win was a surprise. Virginia, I don't think was a huge surprise. But what did get my attention, Miami-Dade just elected a Democratic mayor. Yeah. I think it's been, what, 32 years since they had one. And the Democrats are very smart to move away from the more social issues to the kitchen table issues.
Yep.
So, yeah, I think this is an increasing risk.
Yeah.
But federally, if there's a clean sweep in 28, then I think we need to rethink that at the federal level.
Yeah, get this. Yeah, you know, it's not just the state of Washington. I looked it up. There are 17 states in the country that have either an inheritance tax or an estate tax. And they did have it on the ballot in California at one point. But I got to think that, you know, that's going to be back on the ballot again at some point in time.
Likely. I mean, it's interesting that everybody looks at California saying, you know, the taxes are out of control. And they are, by the way. But I will tell you, in New York, especially if you live in New York City, between the combined city and state tax, the real estate taxes, and I live in Westchester County, about an hour outside the city. I dream about a Prop 13, but you also take the inheritance and estate taxes in New York. New York's got California beat on taxes, I got to tell you that.
You guys have inheritance tax in New York?
Yeah. Yes.
Oh my God, I didn't realize that. Yeah. So, you know, beyond estate planning, I mean, obviously estate planning is going to be a big issue. And like you said, it's sad to think, but deciding on what state you want to have your last breath in makes a difference, I guess. But do you see any other challenges to the long-term historic growth in U.S. GDP, which is basically the foundation of, you know, my whole investment approach and my equity investing and the returns that we've had over the last couple of decades? Do you see, hear all this talk about, you know, the Mamdani socialist Democrats, do you see anything that actually would fundamentally change GDP growth rates in the United States?
Yeah, so a few things, and you know, a couple of them are just completely almost unhandicappable, you know, geopolitics, Russia or China, China/Taiwan, you know, the challenges in the Middle East. I mean, those things are, those could become serious issues within our borders of our country. I think the one thing that's very challenging for, Mark, people of your and my generation, and we're close enough in age, is that we grew up in a capitalistic system. And what a lot of people forget, and you know, so my kids and your kids are within, you know, close enough to the same age. And that that is, from a block of demographics, the 18 to 39 year old is a bigger block than the north of 65. And so when I listen to some of these folks talk, and they think socialism is cool, and I'm not saying capitalism is perfect, even though I'm a dyed-in-the-wool capitalist, not saying nothing is perfect, nothing is all, well, there are some things that are all evil, I shouldn't say that, but socialism is not cool. Margaret Thatcher totally got it right. We all know her famous quote, but I think one of the issues is, and I'll relay a conversation I had with my son once, my son who's about to be 31, as I said, you know, he was telling me he's going on this trip with his girlfriend, he went there with his buddies, blah, blah, blah. And I said to him, Jesus, in my next life, I'm coming back as you and your friends. And he didn't bat an eyelash. He looked dead in the eye. He goes, I'll never own a home. And that's the mindset. Now, my son's a capitalist. He actually works for UBS, which is, you know, so I'm glad he's a capitalist. But I see a lot of people in that generation who don't see the American dream, can't see their way towards, it doesn't have to own a house, it's accumulating wealth. They see a system, and Lord knows, they're, as I said, I love capitalism, but it's had its problems. Just hang on one second. Yeah. They see the bad actors, whether it's the Bernie Madoffs of the world, and they think the system's rigged against them. And so if we go down that path of socialism is cool and we keep pushing that, that I think could be a real problem.
Well, I mean, again, maybe we just think alike too much. This is just repetitive. But, you know, I was thinking about some of these issues before our call, and the idea that the first time home buyer now is north of 40 years old. And is that really an affordability issue, or is that really maybe the kids kept talking about, they don't want stuff, they want experiences. They live the high life. They're getting married at a much later age. A lot of them are not even having kids. It's a completely different model. You know, where were you?
Yeah, you're totally right. And so, I mean, some of it is purely, you know, when I say societal, it's, you know, if you go back to 1950, the age of marriage for men and women was roughly 21 and 20. In 2024, I think it was 30 and 29 or something like that. The quote, adult decisions are happening later. So some of it's affordability. I think that's unarguable. But I mean, those who are jumping on and saying it's pure affordability, no, I agree with you that there are other things going on.
Yeah.
It's experiences and versus stuff.
Right. And the Instagram effect. It's like, hey, wait a minute. Everybody in the world is living this grand life. I deserve this, that, or the other thing. And, you know, there's an artificial expectation. So,
yeah, I agree with that.
Yeah. You know what? Thank God that in Australia, they put in a new law, no access to social media until you're 16 years old. And I think that's a great law.
Sign me up right now.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So let's summarize this. People are probably, we don't want them to fall asleep on us. The affordability issues, I mean, it's a great platform for the Democrats, probably really helps them in the midterms. And, you know, frankly, I think it's nice to see them coming back towards the middle, but this is not a problem. You know, the problem that exists is just not something easily solved. That's a, you know, longer term societal issue. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely.
And then the second thing is that the expected returns, as you stated, UBS says long-term rates will come back down to 3.75%-ish. 10-year treasury is like a 4.20%, at least it was earlier today. So
yeah,
that would
just
be...
Mark, just one thing.
Yeah.
So that's the point in time. That's looking at some point in 26. It may not be a straight line there. We could bounce up before we bounce down. So I just want to make sure people are understanding that.
If we break below 4%, and we do it because inflation's low instead of because the economy is falling apart, that would be so supportive of PE ratios and that whole overvaluation narrative. So
absolutely, totally agree.
Yeah. If we get earnings growth, like you were saying, in that 10-11% zone and get a market that advances 10 or 12% next year, I mean, that is pretty sweet. That is a very optimistic outlook.
That would be a good backdrop if we could have that. Hey, look, it's a long way between here and there. And, you know, you've got the president out there doing his affordability tour. It's going to be met with a lot of pushback from the other side of the aisle. So it's going to be an interesting, I think we all need to strap in for 26.
Yeah, I think you're probably right. It's a little distressing. Well, there's sports, right? We don't have to watch the news.
Well, I'm a Giants fan, so there's no sports for me. So.
Could be the Jets. It could be worse.
No, I think it is actually worse for me, but anyway.
Okay. Well, John, I appreciate you as a friend, and I appreciate you coming on the call today and wasting an hour of your life.
This is one of my favorite things to do at UBS, is to speak with you and be able to talk to your clients and interact with your clients, and I always enjoy it, and I look forward to doing it again.
Oh, you're a good man. Thank you so much. And for all of you out there, I really appreciate you. Thank you so much for your friendship and your business. And until next month, this is Mark and John signing off. Thank you, everybody. Right. Bye-bye.
Take care, everybody. Bye.
This podcast is presented for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as investment advice or the basis for making any investment decisions. It does not constitute an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any specific product or service. UBS does not provide legal or tax advice, and we would recommend listeners to obtain appropriate independent professional advice. Some of the views and opinions expressed may not be those of UBS Group AG or its affiliates. UBS Financial Services, Inc. offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC-registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC-registered broker-dealer. These services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the agreements and disclosures that we provide about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review client relationship summary provided at ubs.com/relationship summary. UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS Group AG and is a member of FINRA and SIPC.
This podcast was edited by Resonate Recordings.